Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event. My name's Julia Wheeler, and I can think of no better way than opening this year's Travel Festival, Travel Writers Festival, than with a man who has done so much to transport us and make travellers of us all through his fiction. While we've sat in our armchairs, huddled in front of February's log fires, we've been warmed by the image of the Mediterranean sun, lulled by descriptions of dolphins among the sea's rhythmic waves, and enthralled by the heat and passion of his characters. Today we're concentrating on the Mediterranean, but I think we may venture into other places as well. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Louis de Bernier.
Thank you. But can you hear me?
That's the important thing.
Okay.
We're going to start with some poetry.
How many of you understand French? Okay. The thing is, I'd love to read you a fairly short poem in French, and then I'll translate it roughly. It's by Georges Moustaki, who was sort of encapsulates the Mediterranean in one person. He was, and it's of Italian origin. He was Jewish. His family lived on Corfu, and then moved to Alexandria, which was a very cosmopolitan city in those days. And his mother spoke six languages, his father spoke five languages. He was educated in French and ended up living in Paris. And he always had a terrible nostalgia for Alexandria. And so I would like to read you this poem just for the if you don't understand French, it doesn't matter because you'll get some of the music despite my terrible accent. And then I'll translate it roughly for you. This is called In the Mediterranean, en Méditerranée. Dans ce bassin où jouent des enfants aux yeux noirs, il y a trois continents et des siècles d'histoire. Des prophètes de Dieu, le Messie en personne. Il y a un bel été qui ne craint pas l'automne en Méditerranée. Il y a l'odeur du sang qui flotte sur ses rives et des pays meurtris comme autant de plaies vives, des îles barbelées, des murs qui emprisonnent. Il y a un bel été qui ne craint pas l'automne en Méditerranée. Il y a des oliviers qui meurent sous les bombes, là où est apparue la première colombe, des peuples oubliés de la guerre moissonnée. Il y a un bel été qui ne craint pas l'automne en Méditerranée. Dans ce bassin, je jouais lorsque j'étais enfant. J'avais les pieds dans l'eau, j'ai respiré le vent. Mes compagnons de jeu sont devenus des hommes, les frères de ceux-là que le monde abandonne. En Méditerranée. Le ciel est endeuillé par-dessus l'acropole et liberté ne se dit plus en espagnol. On peut toujours rêver d'Athènes et Barcelone. Il reste un bel été qui ne craint pas l'automne en Méditerranée. Well, in this basin where there play children with black eyes, there are three continents and centuries of history. Prophets of God, the Messiah himself. There is a beautiful summer which does not fear the autumn in the Mediterranean. There is the stink of blood which floats on the streams and bruised countries full of open wounds. Islands surrounded by barbed wire, walls which imprison. There's a beautiful summer which doesn't fear the autumn in the Mediterranean. There are olive trees murdered by bombs, where there first appeared the first dove. Forgotten people harvested by war. There is a beautiful summer which does not fear the autumn in the Mediterranean. In this basin where I played as an infant, I had my feet in the water, I breathed the wind. The companions of my games have become men, the brothers of those that the world abandons in the Mediterranean. The sky is in mourning above the Acropolis. Liberty has nothing to say in Spain. One can always dream of Athens and Barcelona. There remains a beautiful summer which does not fear autumn in the Mediterranean. Excellent.
Thank you very much. What a wonderful way to start. There is that longevity, isn't there?
Well, yes, you can consider that he wrote that sometime in the early 1970s. You know, the sky is in mourning above the Acropolis. Well, it still is. Although liberty has now found its place, its way into Spain, at last. So things can change. But, you know, the olive trees are still being bombed.
Let's take you back and think about the first time that you were sort of inspired by the Mediterranean. What took you there? What did you love when you got there?
Well, I actually went out there at the age of 8 weeks in a bomber, because my father was in the British Army and he was in Jordan. And so my mother had to take me out in a Stirling bomber. She said she couldn't hear me crying because the engines were so loud. And we lived in a tent in the desert for ages. Obviously, I don't remember that. And then we were sent to Cyprus, and I don't remember that either. So, but I think I first went there when I was about 18 years old. I had one of these Interrail tickets. I don't know if you can still get them.
No, you can.
And I went with my sister and her friend Christina, and we had a one-man tent. So three of us in this tiny tent. And Christina had the most enormous breasts, so there was even less room than there should have been. And we got off the train at Port Bou in the south of France, and I remember it was absolutely baking hot. We had these huge rucksacks full of junk that we didn't need, you know, saucepans and God knows what. And my little sister just said, "It's horrible, I want to go home." It actually did improve from there. We went round the coast into Spain and stayed at a place called Llanza, which is next to Cadaqués, where Salvador Dali had his eccentric garden, you know, with the boat in it. And I think probably my 2 weeks in Spain were what really sort of got me stuck into the Mediterranean. There was even a monkey on the campsite that lived in a bush.
And then when you were a little older, you became a waiter in Corfu. Tell us about that.
No, I didn't become a waiter in Corfu.
No,
what happened was that I went to Corfu with a girlfriend who dumped me on the last day of the holiday. And it was actually a really nasty, bad place. It was called Ipsos in Corfu. The beach was covered with fag ends and beer cans. The dogs howled all night because of the discotheques. It was a plague of horseflies. It was hell on earth. And I was so brokenhearted by this whole thing that a couple of years later, I went back on my own. And I had a lovely time on my own. If you go on your own, you can actually make friends with the local people. I went to the other side of the island, and I made friends with the waiters in the taverna there. And this guy called Nikos, I started talking about how much I loved the music and they were playing in the tavernas. I thought it was traditional music. And he said, "No, it's not traditional. This is actually contemporary, and it's demotic, but it's written by our best composers, you know, Theodorakis, Hadjidakis, Zahakos." And he said, "Not only did they write the music, but they have set to music the lyrics of our greatest modern poets." I thought, actually, back then, the Greek pop music was the best in the world. And I think it was that music and that poetry that got me sort of seriously embedded in the Mediterranean, you know. I fell in love with the Mediterranean through Greek music and poetry.
And for both of your settings of the two books that we're going to talk about today, Captain Corelli's Mandolin and Birds Without Wings,
yeah.
It was travel that took you to those places, and you found those places for that setting, didn't you?
Yes. I've always been more motivated by narrative than anything else. And if I find a good narrative, I'll put in all the work I need to make sure I do it properly. And if you go to Kefalonia, or Kefalonia, as you should say it, if you go to Kefalonia, the first thing you hear on the tourist bus is, "After the earthquake in 1953, because the guide wants you to understand that the reason there's no great architecture in Kefalonia is because it was all destroyed by an earthquake. And when I heard this, I was immediately intrigued, because I got really fed up with writing fake Latin American novels. I wanted to move on to something else, where there was no magic realism, for example. I got very fed up with magic realism. But I like novels where big events happened, and I'd never done an earthquake before. So I decided, really, on the spot, that I should set a novel in Kefalonia just to get the earthquake in. And then, of course, I discovered that it had been occupied by the Italians in the Second World War, who had got on reasonably well with the locals. The Italians didn't have any theories about racial superiority, so they didn't treat the Greeks as if they were animals. But then, of course, when Italy changed sides in the war, the Germans turned on their former allies and massacred them. And given these circumstances, it seemed to me very obvious that I could have a sort of Romeo and Juliet story, you know, love across the barricades. Somebody else had done it before, actually. There was a book called The White Flag in Kefalonia, but it was a very little book compared to mine. So that's what really set me off. I spent a couple of weeks with a moped just hurtling around the island, picking up stories. There's a pine marten in the story, some of you may remember, and that came about because I found one in the road that had been run over. And I had no idea that pine martens lived in Greece as well as in Scotland.
And just as there was a real pine marten, people have written to you afterwards and said, "You've told my story," or "I knew the doctor."
Yes. The book somehow tapped into some sort of collective unconscious. It was very strange. I got letters saying, "I knew Captain Crowley, but he played the piano." And somebody else saying, "I knew Dr. Yanis, but he didn't have a daughter."
That must be wonderfully flattering, though, that you've captured it so wonderfully.
Well, I ended up with six people who were supposed to be Captain Corelli.
Which rather proves the point that he's fictional.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what about the setting for Birds Without Wings?
Birds Without Wings came about because of an abandoned town. It was because of an earthquake. There was an abandoned town in southwest Turkey near Fethiye, which is called Kayakoy, which means rock town. But it used to be called Levisi when it was full of Greeks. This town, it used to have a mixed population of Muslims and Christians, probably Armenians and Jews as well. And it spread up a hillside. And they had a lovely way of life there. You can tell from the way the town's organized. For example, the houses had cisterns of water to collect water off the roof. They had an outside loo on the corner of the houses. It must have been quite busy because, you know, the streets were only wide enough for a donkey. And the Christian population had left in about 1922 after the war between the Greeks and the Turkish nationalist army of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. The Greeks lost that war, and the great powers, you know, the British, the Italians, the French, we imposed the Treaty of Lausanne on them, whereby there was a population exchange, and the Christians had to leave Turkey and go to Greece, and the Muslims had to leave Greece and go to Turkey. Even if they did not speak the language, the ethnicity was decided on the basis of religion. So you had Turkish-speaking Christians sent to Greece and being told they were Greeks. In Syria, there's a community of, there's a village where they all speak the Cretan dialect of Greek because these were Muslims who were thrown out of Crete. Actually, I suspect that community is no longer there after this terrible civil war. But the Christians who lived in that town were the sort who used to dig up the dead after a few years. The women would dig up the dead and wash the bones in wine. The bones would be collected in a linen cloth and stacked in an ossuary with a cross on the forehead and the name of the person concerned. So, and you still see these ossuaries all over Greece. They still do this in Crete and in Athens, for example. And I was looking at these two ossuaries in that town, and there were no bones. I thought, well, where are the bones? Muslims don't disturb the dead. It's something they just don't do. So I thought, well, The only explanation for this is that when the Christians left, they must have taken the bones with them. They took the bones of their mothers and fathers and their relatives and their friends instead of sensible things like pots and pans. And I thought, if my theory was correct, it's worth writing a whole book just to get this one image. So I wrote the whole book just for that one image, the people leaving with the bones of the dead. And some years later, I was reading a novel by Kazantzakis, which is set in Crete, and he describes Christian refugees arriving with sacks of bones over their shoulders. So my theory was correct.
And when you are writing, when you first come up with the idea for a novel, is it often an image that you start with rather than a scenario or a vignette or a line?
I haven't written so many novels that I can establish a rule.
You've written a few.
Normally what happens, well, yes, you get some sort of crucial event, like the earthquake or finding the empty ossuaries. Then you get characters turning up and they sort of say, you know, write me, you know, I'm here, write me, you know. So Dr. Yanis is like that from Captain Corelli. I mean, whenever I try and write about a middle-aged or older man, it's Dr. Yanis trying to sneak back in with a false moustache. And it's kind of, I keep telling him to go away. And I've decided that I'm going to give him a cameo appearance in my next novel. Just to shut him up for a bit. But Pelagia, for example, I was sitting in a cafe in Augustoli, and in the cafe next door, there was an absolutely lovely Greek girl dressed in white with long, long black hair. And she was a waitress. And I was doing what men do. I was just girl watching. And I thought, I've got to have her in a novel. So she, you know, she became Pelagia, even though I know nothing about her.
Did you ever see her again?
No, never again. No.
That's wonderful. She's out there somewhere.
She is out there. And she's a middle-aged woman now.
Nothing wrong with that. Have I got the pronunciation right? Drusula.
Yeah.
So she was, people may well remember from Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and then of course she turns up and is knocking at you to write her as well in Birds Without Wings.
Yes, there's a woman called Drusula in Captain Corelli's Mandolin. She's big and fat and ugly, but you know, her husband adored her. She's had a good marriage, you know, but she's. She is one of those refugees from Anatolia. And when I was writing Birds Without Wings, I suddenly realized that I could have Drusula in there. And that would make Birds Without Wings a sort of prequel to Captain Corelli's Mandolin. It was just too good a chance to pass up. Although it wasn't a part of my original intention. So Drusula is a young woman getting engaged, getting married in Birds Without Wings. And then in Captain Corelli's Mandolin, she's there much older and she's a widow.
And there's so much in your novels and in your poetry that deals with the senses. But I think for me, and perhaps for members of the audience, part of the wonderful thing is that you get under the skin of those Mediterranean people.
That's a statement rather than a question.
But, it is.
But do
you agree?
It's really odd. It's very, after Captain Corelli came out, I had Greeks saying, how come you know us so well? You know, how long have you lived here? And I had to say, I'm sorry, I've just been there quite a lot, for not very long. And I had the same thing in Turkey. She said, how come you know us so well? Are you a Turk? I had an interviewer like you and in Bursa. He said, I'm a Turk. How come you know me? You know, and I actually don't know the answer. I accept that I sort of assume that people are very much the same all over the world. But we have different ways of expressing what we are. So you don't do romantic love in Saudi Arabia, for example, do you? But, so you put all your love into your relatives and your children. You know, your networks of cousins. That's where your love goes. And in our culture, it's often very much diverted towards our sexual partner, isn't it? But we've got the same amount of love, it's just expressed differently. We all suffer jealousy, we all have feelings of shame, we all have a sense of honour. The sense of honour is very, very important in Greece and Turkey. The Greeks call it philotimo, and the Turks have exactly the same code of honour, but they call it something else. So they do have the same motives and emotions as we do, and it's just a question of working out how they express them.
You're best known for Captain Corelli,
yeah.
But actually you said that Birds Without Wings is the book that you'd like to be remembered for. Why is that?
Well, Captain Corelli's Mandolin was my first attempt at writing War and Peace, and I sort of didn't quite feel I'd made it.
And do you feel that you've made it with Birds Without Wings?
When I finished Birds Without Wings, I thought, yeah, I've done it this time, I've pulled it off. So I'm much more proud of Birds Without Wings, and when I finished it, I thought, okay, I can die now, it doesn't really matter. You know, I've done what I came to do. Anything after that feels like a bonus. And a lot of people in Turkey have told me that they think it is their War and Peace. So I sort of don't mind if Brits don't think it's War and Peace, but it's important to me that the Turks think it is.
It's a fantastic compliment.
Well, I drove into Bursa recently, and there were huge posters of me down the side of the highway. And that does not happen in Norfolk.
So what you have turned to more recently, you've said that poetry was your first literary love, really,
yeah.
But you've come back round to that. And Imagining Alexandria deals with, well, you tell us what it deals with.
Well, Alexandria was a cosmopolitan city until it was destroyed by Colonel Nasser. Nasser really expelled all the foreigners, especially the Greeks. He made life impossible for them. So Alexandria is no longer the sort of cosmopolitan hub of the Levant that it used to be. It used to be full of Jews and Greeks, all sorts of people, and now it's not. But there was a poet called Konstantin Kavafis, who was a Greek from Istanbul. His family was from Istanbul. They moved to Alexandria. He was homosexual. He wrote very frankly about his erotic life, but without ever being gross or objectionable. And he was very much preoccupied with Greece of classical times. So he liked...
Is that better?
Did you get any of that?
Okay.
So, yes, he was very interested in the time when Hellenic culture was spread all the way from Spain to India. Anyone who wanted to think themselves educated had to learn Greek. So educated Romans preferred Greek to Latin, for example. So he wrote a lot of narratives in poetry about those times. Quite quirky, actually, a lot of them. And... I love Kavafis. I have loved Kavafis ever since I discovered him in a bookshop in Kefalonia years and years and years ago. And for many years, I didn't realize that his poetry was homosexual, because love poetry is just love poetry, isn't it? And because of reading so much Kavafis, I started writing a lot of things either inspired by him or in his manner. And there came a point about 3 years ago when I suddenly realized that I actually had enough of these poems to make a whole volume.
Check, check, check.
And so I sort of, you know, touched wood and decided to get them published. It was a bit of a risk because, you know, in Britain they hate it if you do more than one thing, and they especially hate it if you're good at more than one thing.
Hasn't stopped you.
Well, in the end, I sort of think it's for posterity just to decide whether you're any good or not.
No. Well, we've got some of his poetry, haven't we, that you're going to read. Do you want to... I'm going to grab
okay.
the book from over here with your poetry.
Okay. Kavafis's most famous poem is probably Ithaca. And I think the poem is self-explanatory. I won't... Where is it? Can you see it? Here it is. This isn't the translation I love the most, but it'll give you the idea. As you set out for Ithaca, hope the voyage is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Laestrygonians and Cyclops, angry Poseidon, do not be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way. as long as you keep your thoughts raised high, as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body. Laestrygonians and Cyclops, wild Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Hope the voyage is a long one. May there be many a summer morning when, with what pleasure, what joy, you come into harbours seen for the first time. May you stop at Phoenician trading stations to buy fine things, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, sensual perfume of every kind, as many sensual perfumes as you can. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to gather stores of knowledge from their scholars. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there, lasts for years, so you are old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you have gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvelous journey. Without her, you would not have set out. She has nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you will have understood by then what all these Ithacas mean.
Thank you very much. And there is the last poem in your collection, Imagining Alexandria. Very obviously inspired by that poem.
This is very hard for me to read, actually. It is my sort of version of Ithaca. It's hard for me to read because I wrote it for whichever of my parents was going to die first. I'll do my best. It's called When the Time Comes. When the time comes, it is better that death be welcome as an old friend who embraces and forgives. Seize advantage of what little time is left, and if imagination serves, if strength endures, if memory lives, take once more their hands and press them to your cheek. Think of you and them as young again, as running in the fields, as drinking wine and laughing. And if you wish, let there be Spanish music, Greek seas and French sun, the hills of Ireland if you loved them, some other place if that should please, some other music more suited to your taste. Consider, if you can, that soon you'll shed this weariness, this pain, the heaped upon indignities. And afterwards, who knows, perhaps you'll walk with angels, should angels be, by fresher meadows, unfamiliar streams. You may find that those who did not love you do so now, that those who loved you did so more than you believed. You may go on to better lives and other worlds. You may meet God, directly or disguised. You may, on the other hand, who knows, just wander off to sleep that seamless, darkest, dreamless, unimaginable sleep. Do not be bitter. No world lasts forever. You who traveled like Odysseus, this is Ithaca. This your destination. This your last adventure. Here is my hand, the living to the dying. Yours will grow cold in mine when the time comes.
Thank you. When Captain Corelli came out, I think you did get some criticism from Greek quarters about the way you portrayed the communists there in the islands. Now, I do know quite a bit about Greek history, particularly in the Second World War, and I think what you write is accurate, and I recognise your sources. But you rather backed off an interview from that, saying, well, maybe I got it wrong a bit. I'm not sure where this was, or maybe there are other versions. Do you actually sort of, you don't really feel that, do you? Your picture of there, what happened in the war, is including the communist experience, was actually very accurate and well recorded in your book.
Thank you for saying that. I eventually came up with one reservation, actually. This whole fuss was kicked off by Seamus Milne, who was a journalist for The Guardian, and he's now an advisor to Jeremy Corbyn. But Seamus Milne, he actually was offended rather than anyone else, and he went to Greece to find all these old partisans to tell them that I had been offensive and then to ask them if they were offended. So it was all cooked up by The Guardian. And as a result, actually, I refused to talk to The Guardian for about 10 years afterwards. The Guardian were always terribly good at misrepresenting me. The reservation that I came up with was, I do stick by my account of the behaviour of the communist partisans in the south of Greece. So, for example, they annihilated the royalist resistance instead of fighting the Germans. In Kefalonia, the communist resistance killed a lot of Greeks. They didn't kill one Italian or German. The reservation I have is that at the time of writing the book, I thought that the partisans were controlled centrally from Athens. So I thought the systematic misbehavior was actually on the orders of the communist headquarters in Athens. But it turns out, actually, that Athens had very little control over what the partisans were doing in different parts of the country. They wouldn't have been aware, for example, necessarily that Aris was set on annihilating the royalist resistance. And they wouldn't have been aware, really, necessarily, what was happening in Kefalonia. There were lots of semi-autonomous bands all over Greece. So my reservation is that some of those bands did behave in a reasonably civilized way. So, for example, somebody from Epirus told me, well, the communists used to give us drama classes, you know. So that's my only reservation, that I was wrong in thinking it was controlled from the center, but I was not wrong in, for example, describing the activities of the partisans in the south of Greece after they blew up the Yorgopotamos Bridge. Does that answer your question? Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Another question over here.
Good morning, Louise. Some of the words in your book, The Dust That Falls, and in the poem you just read, you mentioned soul, and you mentioned God. So may I, with respect to the audience, could I please ask you, sir, what exactly do you mean by your soul, which you mention in your poem?
I think this is a very difficult philosophical question, isn't it? Or a very difficult theological question. The word soul, it gets used in poetry and music so much that we all sort of know what it means without being able to pin anything precise upon it. And it gets... I'm getting round to it, but if you're asking me to give you my own profession of faith, I'm probably not going to. Because I have a very dodgy relationship with God. Well, I can address it if you like. In my teen, I was brought up a high Anglican, right? And I really didn't question my religious faith at all until in South America, in Colombia, I saw a young woman killed in a railway accident. Now, this young woman had been chatting to me, so I knew her personally. She'd actually gone off to get me a glass of beer. And on this train, there was no concertina to stop you falling out between the carriages. And when she was going off to get me some beer, these ridiculous platform shoes that people used to wear in those days, and she fell out of the train sideways and was actually stripped to the bone down one side. So the train was reversed and we had to carry her in. And she took about 2 hours to die. And what happened to me was the sort of exact opposite of what happened to St. Paul on the road to Damascus. Which, St. Paul had his revelation of of where his faith should lie when he saw the blinding light on the road to Damascus and heard the voice saying, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? With me, what happened was I suddenly thought, where is God? You know, where is the moral order? Where is the purpose behind this? You know, where is divine goodness? Where is omnipotence? So that I think answers your question. That when you have been religious, you know, it never entirely leaves you. It doesn't. He's making signals to me, which I don't understand. But anyway, the thing about religion is it provides you with lots of wonderful stories and also a set of metaphors, which are definitely of value in poetry. And it's almost impossible to let them go. For example, we all know what we mean by a soulmate, don't we? That's your ideal partner, you know, the other half of your platonic androgyne. And to use the word soul, it sort of doesn't tell you anything philosophically, but it tells you a lot poetically. Does that answer your question at all? Okay.
So, we'll have to continue that on another occasion. Anybody else got any questions? We can get a microphone to you. Okay, well, I have.
Okay.
Following on from the poem Ithaca, Greek myth pops up, you know, throughout your work. Talk to us about that, particularly from Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Well, nobody noticed this, as far as I know, but in Captain Corelli's Mandolin, it was just absolutely stuffed with references to the Odyssey. I hadn't at that time read the Iliad, so I wasn't able to be influenced by it, but I'd read the Odyssey, and it seemed to be absolutely, you know, full of wonderful things that I could just use. So, for example, Penelope, to keep her suitors away, She's making a shroud, isn't she? She's making a shroud. And every night she unpicks the shroud so that it'll never be finished and she doesn't have to commit to marrying any of these suitors who turn up in her house and are abusing her hospitality. And in Captain Crowley's Mandolin, Pelagia is making a waistcoat which she never feels she can get right. You know, she unpicks the embroidery and Mandras tells her that the embroidery is not symmetrical. You know, and so she unpicks it, and the waistcoat never really gets finished until she eventually shows it to Captain Corelli, who likes the asymmetry. That when Mandras is coming back from the front, he has these episodes, I think, involving pigs, I seem to remember, which are reminiscent of Circe in the Odyssey.
It's also the pine marten, isn't it, that recognizes him.
Oh, yes, it's the pine marten that recognizes Mandras. And, of course, in the Odyssey, it's the lovely old dog who recognizes Odysseus when he comes home.
And the other thing, I'm taking a chance here, because I don't know this for sure, but Guercio means one-eyed in Italian, doesn't it? Did you have some fun with the name there in terms of Cyclops, or is that just coincidence?
I'm afraid that's a coincidence.
Well, it works really well.
On the last page there's a of Captain Corelli, there's a description of three girls on a moped, right? And one of them is driving. I think the one in the middle is doing her makeup, and the one on the back is facing backwards reading a newspaper or something. Anyway, and people have asked me, are these the three fates? You know, is this an allusion to the three fates? And other people said, is this past, present, and future? I thought, wow, that's a clever idea, because the fact is that the three girls, the three lovely young girls on the moped, is something I actually saw on one of the Greek islands. And I thought, that just encapsulates the whole spirit of Greece. You know, beautiful young girls, bare-legged, being really stupid, too many loaded onto one moped, and just not giving a damn. So I put that image there, actually, in order to inspire Captain Corelli to write a Greek concerto. And it was only later that anyone thought it might be to do with mythology. But certainly, I mean, I do love those ideas that it's the three fates and it's past, present, and future. But to be honest, it was just something I saw.
Isn't that wonderful as a novelist when people take your work and then make more of it or read more into it than perhaps you'd imagined?
Well, you become fuel for academics. It's really quite funny. If any of you are French, you will know that French literary academics are obsessed with the body. So French literary criticism has to be about the body. So there's a character called Jean-Louis Chevalier, who's written a treatise about the body in my work. It's not something that I ever thought of, you know, doing on purpose. There was another academic who got obsessed with any mention of prostitution. I think he had his own agenda.
Looking for literature well, to get deep with.
Yes, it's quite entertaining. And I sometimes get letters from people saying, please could you explain your use of simile and metaphor? And you just know they're doing their A-levels. So I write back, I say, I'll write your essays if you write my novels.
Perfect. What a wonderful place to end. Thank you very much, Louis Bernier. Louis is now going to be going over just to the Stanford signing area just there. It's most convenient. You can pick up books there. Continue the chat there if you'd like to do that. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for those two deep questions.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Most of all, thank you so much, Louis de Bernier.